This episode of the Bulak podcast was produced in collaboration with the Barjeel Art Foundation, an independent Sharjah-based institution founded in 2010 by Sultan Saud al-Qasimi to preserve, exhibit, and research one of the most extensive collections of modern and contemporary art from the Arab world. One of the Barjeel Art Foundation's objectives is developing a public platform to foster critical dialogue around art practices, to convey nuanced Arab histories beyond the borders of culture and geography. The book, The Life and Work of Inci Eflatun, edited by Sultan Saud al-Qasimi and Suheyla Takesh, exemplifies this mission. Scheduled for publication in October 2025, the book presents a number of newly commissioned essays, along with an English translation of a volume originally published in Arabic in 1993. Based on an interview with the artist, a leading Egyptian feminist, political activist, curator, and visual artist, the book explores the political, social, and cultural dimensions of a complex and turbulent period in Egypt's history. For more information about the Barjeel Art Foundation's activities and exhibitions, please visit www.barjeel, spelt B-A-R-J-E-E-L, artfoundation.org. Welcome to episode 115 of the Bulak podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay, my co-host is Marsha Links Quayle, and our two guests today are Avery Gonzalez and Ahmed Gobba. They are joining us to talk about the Egyptian artist, feminist, and political militant Inci Eflatun. Avery and Ahmed co-translated Eflatun's memoir into English for a new book, The Life and Work of Inci Eflatun, published by Skira. This project was supported by the Barjeel Art Foundation, and in addition to Eflatun's memoir, the book also contains a number of essays about her and, of course, beautiful reproductions of her work. Ahmed is a development finance professional, translator, and Arab art enthusiast whose career has taken him from his native Egypt through Oman and Singapore to his current home in Rabat, Morocco. Avery is a translator, education professional, and community builder based in Los Angeles, California. He has lived in Beirut and Amman and previously worked at the Getty Research Institute in California. I think we'll let them tell the story of how they met and collaborated on translating the memoir of an Egyptian female artist born in 1924. A woman who was from a rarefied social background, but ended up at the forefront of anti-colonialist and feminist struggle, who spent years in prison for her commitment to communism, and who wrote political pamphlets and manifestos, but perhaps more importantly, developed a distinctive style of painting to capture scenes from Egyptian life. And I think I could have probably recognized an Inci Eflatun painting, and I certainly knew her name, and I knew that she'd been in prison, but I knew very little else about her before reading this book. So it was a real pleasure, and it's a real pleasure to have you guys on today.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so if we could just start out with, you know, for the reader and listener who doesn't know that, who maybe can recognize an Inci Eflatun painting, but doesn't know much about her background, if you guys through, the, you know, from what you've learned through this project, if you could introduce her to our listeners to kind of, you know, give us the kind of key highlights of her life.
Yeah, I can take it first because I think it's related to my family's background in a way. So Inci Eflatun, as Ursula mentioned, is one of the most important Egyptian painters, but also is a feminist and activist from the 20th century. I think her background is quite interesting because she was born in a rich Cairo family, but that family hailed from a rural town called Kafr Shokr, where her family was part of the land-owning elite. Her background is specifically interesting, and Avery and I have spoken about this multiple times, is because for someone who was born in a French-speaking cosmopolitan household, she actively chose as a teenager to delve into her Egyptian identity. And that's what stuck with her. And you can see that through her paintings throughout life. So I think that's who Inci Eflatun is to me. What about you?
Yeah, that's a great summary. I think I would add a couple fun facts in there. One is the name Eflatun. Not if you don't speak Arabic, you may not know that Eflatun is the Arabized name for Plato. And her family's moniker was Plato because her grandfather talked so much in the military, which I think is just a funny example of kind of how names stick with families and become kind of identifying factors. She was incredibly active in her early 20s and 30s in the political scene and really exemplified activism and, like Ahmed said, involvement in the Egyptian intellectual and political scene. And yeah, her art is among the best known in the region. And I think its iconic characteristics, such as the colors and her ways of depicting people, especially the Fedaheen in the Egyptian countryside, really make her stand out among others.
Yeah, I guess to kind of follow up on that. So, you know, I think, you know, as Ursula and I both mentioned, we would recognize an Inci Eflatun painting. So what is it that we are recognizing? What are the elements of an Inci Eflatun, you know, a sort of a iconic Inci Eflatun painting?
I think for me, the first things that stand out are her origins in the Surrealist movement. She was inspired by a lot of Surrealists from the Art and Liberty group in Egypt, as well as internationally. And she was one of their youngest members, as early as the age of 16, I believe. And she drew a lot of inspiration from them. But after, you know, years of political struggle, she really developed her own identity, again, drawing from rural working class subjects in the Egyptian countryside and the factories, and especially from her time in prison, just painting everyday people and their political circumstances, their economic and their social circumstances as well. I think the colors are truly iconic. There's oranges, there's pinks, there's lots of white space, which is actually the topic of some of the essays on her work, using kind of negative space in really creative ways. And I think that's, yeah, generally where it comes from.
As Avery mentioned, I think her style developed a lot through the times. You can tell from her early work, which was in the maybe late 30s and early 40s, she was very inspired by the Surrealist movement. And a lot of the paintings that she did was to just capture her emotions as a rebellious teenager, which she talks about in her book, expressing herself through art. But as she her political consciousness grew, she moved a little bit more from surrealism to more social realism, where she was depicting more of her the political movements that she was a part of and so on. And then which eventually brought her to her most famous series, which is her series in prison, where you can see that the partners were a lot more intimate, you know, capturing facial features and facial emotions very deeply of her fellow female prisoners. And I think towards after that, at post-prison, she focused a lot on sort of painting these portraits in her family's hometown in Kafr Shukr of the orange fields and so on. And as Avery correctly pointed, a lot of it is vibrant colors, so greens, oranges, and so on. So you can really track how her style changed with the stage of life that she was facing. And it also, to me, highlights that for her, art was not a separate endeavor. Her political activism and day-to-day life was inseparable from her art.
So you mentioned her being a rebellious teenager. I would like to talk a little bit more about, again, her family and her early education. It seems to me there's two very important elements in her life. One is her mother and the life that her mother had when she was young. And the other one is her early schooling. And the both of these things maybe put her on track to be a little bit different from other girls of her class and background.
Sure. I could speak about her mother first. So she was raised by an extremely independent mother who divorced her father after having two kids. And as was not the case at the time. She chose to live and be financially independent with two children. Her name was Salaha, and she owned her own fashion boutique and dress store that made clothes for the Egyptian upper class and even the royalty of Egypt at the time. And she was extremely well known and made lots of trips to Europe, specifically Paris, to interact with the different fashion houses and bring back fabrics and different models for her designs. So from an early age, Inji was inspired by her mother's independence and, I guess, upright character, if you would say that. She was just a person who was very proud of who she was and what skills she had and how she was able to make a life for herself in a time when it was very different in Egypt than it is today, and even more difficult to maintain that lifestyle. So Inji, throughout her life, looked up to her mother and tried to emulate her in many ways.
I really found it fascinating, too, how some of the contradictions she kind of embraced, like in the memoir, she refers to one of the headlines about her as the communist with 40 dresses. Mm-hmm. And some others kind of just kind of sit there, like her, or how important her early French education was and the texts she read. And yet at the same time, you know, she talks about kind of rejecting this French education at the same time. I also wonder, you know, to what extent her mother's dressmaking influenced her art, those fabrics and those textures.
That's a great question. Go ahead, Ahmed.
Yeah, I think maybe not a direct response to that, but what I was thinking of is I think there was a bit of contradiction as well, as you rightly pointed out, in the sense that her mother was very independent, but the way she describes her first school, which is I wouldn't try and say the French name because not to butcher it, but she mentioned that she was put into the school because it was the factory of making an ideal wife. Society, very obedient, very satisfied with whatever outcome her life becomes, whereas her mother, on the other hand, was very independent. So I think even Inji like was aware of this contradiction at first, and I think inspired by her mother partly, she became very rebellious in school, which eventually led to her being transferred out of this Christian school, which was more strict, to a more open school, the Lycée Français in Cairo.
Yeah, that project of the school completely backfired.
Yeah,
I mean, of turning her into an obedient wife.
She exactly. I mean, there is the you can feel the emotion even decades later of how much she hated that school. Like, it seems to have just made her like absolutely adamantly unwilling to like comply in the way that it was intended to.
Yeah, and I would say that's the origins of her class awareness as well. She started to recognize that the mother nun was treated differently than the other sister nuns. And she started to ask why the Muslim students and the Christian and the Jewish students were all treated differently. And she identifies that as a really important phase in her life. Even though she was young, you know, she didn't necessarily have the words to describe it, but that's where she started thinking about, you know, the class separation within Egypt.
Definitely. And I think to the point of it sticking with her, I think the clearest evidence for that for me is that she still remembers the mother nun telling her own mother that your daughter is possessed by the devil. And for that phrase to stick with her all these years, to remember to say it after this long career, I think it's one of those things that, you know, when we grow up, just things stick with us. And I do think that school was instrumental in shaping her, but not in the way that maybe the school had hoped.
Right. No, and so then she ends up going to the Lycée Français, I think, and there, as a teenager, she embraces Marxism and joins this surrealist art and freedom group, and both of those are hugely influential directions for the rest of her life.
Yeah. So, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think when I first read about Inji Eflatun, what was funny about that transition period is when she started taking painting classes. her first teacher, Kamal Telmisani, who was also the one who introduced her to all these ideas about Marxism. One could wonder what was going to his head when he was going to, teach painting to this rich French-speaking girl, thinking that this was just a side job for him, not realizing that this would be someone in the future who would be a staunch activist and a Marxist. Sometimes I think about that and how curious of a situation it would have been for him.
Right. Like, look at the effects of my teaching.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you guys can talk a little bit more about this kind of stages in her art and how, how one of the things that really struck me in the course of this memoir is, both how politically engaged, I guess, sort of consciously politically engaged her art always was, but also how deeply she wanted to be developing her craft, how she mentions even while she's in prison that she, she felt anxious because the other people who were with her in prison weren't qualified really to assess her art and were always telling her everything looked great no matter what. And that she wanted part of the reason to smuggle out her paintings seemed to me to be so that she could hear the opinions of the critics.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. She defines a lot of the phases of her painting in relation to major life events in her book. So first was school. She discovered surrealist painting and made some very expressive paintings, which are showcased in the latter half of the book in her works. One including Girl and Beast. And that one's just very shocking in the, tones, the dark themes that it expresses of kind of a tortured woman in a forest. And then she didn't paint for a long time, and she recognizes this. And this is generally the first half of her book, which is focused on political activism. And the moment that she starts to paint again is once she gets married to Hamdi. And that happens, I believe, in 1950 or 52. And she really picks up painting again as kind of a form of therapy and relaxation after many years of hard political work. She draws a lot more of the Fulahin in the countryside. And she kind of reconnects with her passion. And she speaks of that time very fondly because she interacted with a lot of studios and artists living in Egypt at that time, both European and Egyptian, and took classes from them and did workshops and traveled around the countryside. So that was a very fruitful time. And then another major life event was her husband, Hamdi, sadly passing away many years later, or a few years later, rather. After being detained and beaten, he passed away of a brain hemorrhage. And the shock of that kind of sent her back into a very, very reflective space. And her artwork reflects that sadness in a lot of ways. And thirdly, her time in prison. As Ahmed mentioned, there's a series of portraits and paintings from prison that reflect both the life inside the prison and things she could see outside the windows, such as sailboats and trees. And lastly is kind of her phase after prison, where she really takes a step back, I think, from her political expression in her paintings to paint more decorative, reflective pieces about Egyptian society and the countryside. And it's really beautiful at that later point in her life.
Just to add to that quickly, I do think that one of the inspiring things about Inji is how she was meticulous in what she wanted to focus on and what she wanted to get out of each phase of her life. So even though she also wanted to look at honing her craft, as you mentioned, as you can tell in the book, but actually when she was a teenager, when she had just graduated her high school from the Lycée Français, she talks about how her mother and the rest of her family tried to convince her to go to Paris to join one of the top art schools at the time, where, at the time, that was the best place to be trained as an artist. But she insisted to stay in Egypt because she was really focused at the time on what she calls self-Egyptianization and how she wants to really lean into her Egyptian side to learn Arabic better. And that to me shows how she was very intentional in not just becoming an artist, but also becoming a national Egyptian who's proud of her heritage at the time, which I think speaks volumes of her determination and having that clarity at such a young age.
I think we're going to read a couple excerpts now from this memoir that you translated. And one earlier one that's going to speak to this younger age in which she was very subsumed in political militancy. Avery, can you set this up for us a bit, the passage that we've chosen?
Sure. Yeah. So in 1945, Angie and many of her comrades traveled to Paris for the first conference of kind of international, it was the first international women's conference in the world after World War II. So immediately after the war ended, everyone was traveling to Paris. You can imagine it's very hectic. There's lots of problems traveling, you know, lots of infrastructure is destroyed. And she arrives and the conference is a huge success. There's over 850 delegates from all different countries of the world. And lots of the kind of heroines of the of World War II are present. And she, Angie Eflatun herself, is nominated as the Egyptian delegate, and she has the opportunity to get up and give a speech. The atmosphere that settled over the conference was one of gladness and excitement, with feelings of confidence in a better future for all humanity. Colorful emblems and beautiful feminist banners decorated the walls of the conference hall. Then came the turn of the Egyptian delegation to deliver its opening statement. I remember it as if it was yesterday. I was terrified as I ascended the main podium. I was on edge, and the paper on which I had written the speech in French shook so much that I thought my shaking hands would prevent me from reading. But what happened was odd. The same imposing, rattling crowd was what urged me on. I looked just in front of me. I could see the great number of delegates and the lustrous heroines of the era with gold medals hanging around their chests. I was able to overcome the feelings of confusion and dread, and I spoke. The statement was enthusiastic and impassioned. I wanted it to reflect the enthusiasm and strong commitment of the issues of liberation and nationalism that distinguished the youthful feminist movement for which I spoke. The opportunity had finally arisen for us to speak before the women of the world all about the dictatorship that Egypt had endured for 65 years. We are now able to speak openly about the malignant colonial politics and continuously hinder all progress in our countries. The Egyptian woman refuses to remain as she is now, forbidden from all her rights. She refuses to earn a third of a man's salary for the same labor and without any social security benefits. She refuses to be the employee that is forbidden from holding important positions due to tradition. My speech continued, and I highlighted the Egyptian women's recognition of the original cause of her persecution and backwardness, colonialism, and the authorities who cooperated with it. I also highlighted how there was a strong link between the issues of women's liberation and national liberation. Our ongoing national struggle is at its peak, and the resistance movement has awoken the memory of years of misery and unhappiness in the consciousness of women. She is determined to do her part in the collective path of the nation. There was no instant translation at the time. And I'll stop there.
So interesting, because I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the way in which this memoir was composed, since, you know, it was written or composed later as these kind of snapshots of what she remembers of her life previously.
Sure, I can summarize. She worked with her nephew to record a lot of these conversations on cassette tapes, and she was just speaking her life and telling stories. And then she would go back and listen to these cassette tapes and write them down into notebooks and try to organize her thoughts chronologically. So for the most part, this book is just kind of a recollection of different anecdotes throughout her life punctuated by kind of historical narratives that situate the events in Egyptian history throughout the 40s and 50s. And so she would draft her notebooks and give them to Saeed Khiyal, who is the editor in Arabic. And he would work with that material to organize it, to fact check it, and to run it back by her. And she would often comment and say, no, no, that's not right. Or, oh, I forgot something, and you know, correct him. So it's really her oral history of her life being recreated in written form, thanks to the editor and transcription of her life story.
And it feels like of certain things that she wanted to get down on the record, right? I mean, exactly. There's certain pivotal points that she wants to make, or the certain things that she wants to have remembered. I mean, her politics, which are so fully formed when she's so young, are such a strong combination of, I mean, she's anti-colonialist, also very explicitly feminist and anti-patriarchal. And then with this universalist element to it too, because, you know, although she's anti-colonialist, there's this sort of, you can see this great excitement with, like, you know, forming these alliances and solidarities, which is also a, you know, leftist idea, you know, across countries, across women from around the world. And then also, Ahmed, like you've mentioned multiple times, like her class consciousness being so built around this effort she had to make as a young adult to, like, reconnect with the language, with the culture of her own country that she had sort of felt so alienated from. It all creates a very coherent and sort of new, at the same time coherent and very nuanced sort of political profile.
I wonder if the two of you could now talk a little bit about how you came to this project. So we know that that you both took this class, The Politics of Modern Middle Eastern Art, in 2019, and how you came to the memoir, the process of translating it, and kind of what it meant to you.
Maybe I can start here and hand it over to Avery. So Avery and I met actually in this class where, you know, when Avery was an undergraduate student at Yale and I was a visiting student at Yale, and I was drawn to this class because of wanting to learn about Middle Eastern art. And we were first introduced to Inji by seeing her paintings and then reading a secondary article, I think, by Betty LaDuke in class about her. And that's when I was really intrigued. And I indicated to our instructor at the time, Ustaz Sultan Saud Al-Kasmi, that I was very interested by Inji and I wanted to write about her for our essay for class. And he passed me this version of the memoirs, the original version in Arabic. And as soon as I started reading it, on the first page, I saw that her family, even though she was born in Cairo, her family came from the same small town that my grandfather in Egypt had lived in, and where I often visited when I went back to Egypt. And what struck me then was how there was a difference, first of all, in the sense that her family was the elite land owners. They owned vast majority of land, whereas my grandfather owned a small plot of land that he used. And I thought that that contrast was interesting. But what was more ironic for me is that it took me almost 22 years at that point to hear about Inji Eflatun, and I was hearing about her from the other side, on the other side of the world, at Yale. So I thought this is actually important for me to delve deep into. The idea of translating the book didn't come until maybe a year later when, you know, during the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of lockdowns, and Ustaz Sultan at the time was reconnecting with his older student, with his previous students, with his former students. And when I connected with Ustaz Sultan, we started talking about Inji Eflatun again, and I told him, it's such a shame that these memoirs are not in English. And then he suggested, why don't you translate them? And that's where the idea came about. And because it was lockdown and, you know, I wanted to do something with all of my free time, I started researching and I eventually found the publishing house that owned the translation rights in Arabic and connected over Facebook with someone who works there. And that's where the idea of the project came about. And I think a few months later, I was discussing with Sultan how it would be nice to have a co-translator. And at that point, Avery had reached out to me. And that's when I invited Avery to join me. And I thought that was a great idea at the time because it's such a rich book. And it was not an easy book to translate because she goes from modern standard Arabic to Egyptian Arabic, and she mentions a lot of thoughts that just flow into one another. And I thought having a co-translator like Avery would be very good to work with in order to bounce off ideas off each other on how to approach this project.
Yeah, and to pick up, I was living in Jordan doing the CASA Arabic Fellowship, which has a rich history of producing good translators like Marilyn Booth, who translated Celestial Bodies and many others. And I was taking their translation course and looking for a project. And I remembered that day in Sultan's class when we talked about Injif Latun, he actually brought a copy of her memoir to the class. And I think he like waved it over his head and said, somebody needs to translate this into English. At least that's how I remember it. So I thought of that immediately and got in touch with Sultan, who put me in touch with Ahmed. And from there, it was history. And like Ahmed said, it was actually a challenging undertaking from a research and historical perspective. We ended up making an appendix, I guess just a Google spreadsheet of, I think, almost 200 Arabic names that we had to research online to see if they had an existing English transliteration or a spelling that was broadly accepted. And I think that's a valuable resource in and of itself. Like this text contains so much historical knowledge of kind of the intellectual elite and the kind of newspaper culture of debates back and forth through the time that it's a resource in and of itself.
And yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and weren't you also like on other sides of the world through part of this process?
Exactly. Yeah, I was living in first in Jordan, and then I moved to Los Angeles, California afterwards, while Ahmed was in Singapore and then in Egypt, and now he's in Morocco. So he's all over the place.
Hmm. Yeah, and I have to give it to Avery because our regular time when he was in LA and I was in Singapore was 10 p.m. on Sunday for me, but I think it was 7 a.m. in LA. So a lot of the times we'd start the call and Avery would be like, sorry, I'm just waking up. And I'd be like, I'm so sorry. We have to do this at such an early time of the day for you. But I think finding that cadence where we had a regular time to discuss what we'd translated and reviewed throughout the week, I think that not only, I think, made it a very consistent process, but I think it also, you know, grew our friendship, I would say, on a personal level as well.
And I think the result is that you do hear her voice. I mean, when I'm thinking back to reading it, like after the process of reading it, I had a kind of feeling for, like, there's a consistent voice and personality that comes through in the writing. So I think your collaboration really, really, really worked to deliver something of her. Even as I found her sometimes herself, the things she chose to say or not say, that she herself holds back a fair amount. Like, it's not a memoir, it's not a confessional memoir. It's not something where she gives you a lot of personal information, and sometimes you only, things are very glancingly mentioned that are clearly like very important, and then they're passed over quickly or sort of elided. So it also in a way is, for me, was like a memoir that opened my interest in her. And I almost wish there were more volumes, there was more stories from her.
Well, lucky for you, there's the second half of the the volume, the edited volume that Bargil has put together, which yes. contains some amazing essays.
I really enjoyed those. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, just huge credit to all the authors from, you know, Betty LeDuc back in, I believe, the 80s, who wrote about NGFLATUN, all the way up until now, just some new material coming out. It's really fantastic and expands upon the memoir in a great way.
Yeah, I have to admit that the first one I flipped to was about her relationship with Hamdi. That was something I wanted. I felt there was so much passion in how she told the story of their meeting and the sort of the hilarious story of him coming across her in the police station and pretending he didn't know who she was because they were still keeping their relationship under wraps. I wanted so much more about that, so much more about her relationship with her mother.
Right. Those are the two, I think, in a different kind of autobiography that you might have gotten many, many chapters on. That they're very powerful relationships, you can tell. But yeah, I also appreciate the essays, and I particularly appreciated some of the writing about her work as an artist, because it helped me to see the paintings, which are beautifully reproduced in the book, better, like to actually see what she was doing. I mean, it's not my background, and there's some lovely writing about her work as well as her life.
I think this is the perfect time to also thank, you know, the editors of the book, Ustaz Sultan Saud al-Qasimi, who we've mentioned, but also Suhaila Takish, because while this project started as just the intent was to translate the Arabic memoirs directly, it evolved under Sultan and Suhaila into just expansive book about Inji, which included the memoirs, but also a lot of, as Avery mentioned, essays about her, some of which were translated, some others are new essays about her that were written for this book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so what was the kind of, what was the leap from wanting to produce a translation of this memoir to making this book with all these essays about her and her work as well?
Well, I can't say that was our decision. We were in the thick of translating, you know, just with our heads down, trying to get our draft done. And I think we delivered a draft and then it sat for a while. And then we asked about it. And Sultan said, oh, actually, we're going to make this into a bigger edited volume. So it was entirely Bargil's prerogative to do this. But just looking at, I guess, Bargil's collection of publications, they're really invested in not just publishing the monograph, but kind of a definitive volume about a specific artist and a specific movement. So I think this is kind of in line with their intention to create a really rich history that goes just beyond like the mere publication of the words that have been said, but to include all the essays, a lot of their significant artworks that are owned by Bargil and Mataf and other institutions in the Arab world. And I guess get it into circulation. So I think this is a very successful example of, you know, building on a small project to create a more comprehensive body of knowledge.
I mean, I think you've partly answered the question already, but I was going to ask about sort of how you envision the place that this book will occupy, like in the space of our criticism. I mean, it is in English, the first translation of her memoir, and then a reference, like a book that did not exist before as a reference on her work and her life. What was sort of like, would you say is the ambition or the purpose of the book in the field of like art history or even of biographies of Arab artists and writers, which is a whole field in and of itself?
Yeah, I'll take a stab first and then Ahmed, you can add on. I believe that the role of this publication is to bring the role of women in the mid-20th century to the forefront of the discussion about not just art, but also politics. Injia Flatun was unashamedly, you know, involved in politics, and she spoke on behalf of many movements, the feminist movement, the communist movement, that a lot of things that we consider antonyms today, she embraced, such as, you know, the democratic, communist, nationalist front. And these, this collection of identities and the, I guess, audacity with which she took them on and really represented them on the national and international levels, I think just makes this book kind of a valuable historical resource, as I've already alluded to. In the field of art history, I would say that this the story of Injia Flatun's life really exemplifies how art and politics are connected at many, many points, and how, you know, a country's national struggle and one person's individual struggle defines what they paint about and how they paint about it. And I mean, we just see that time and time again with the topics, with the subjects, and the styles in which Injia Flatun represents her her experiences in art.
I think one thing also about, just as a as an autobiography and as a biography of a of an Egyptian woman artist, and as any woman artist in this period, so many of the life stories that we have, like Latifa Zayed's, Anayet Zayed's, as they begin producing art, their husband, particularly their is like a force of squashing their artistic ambitions. Whereas here, as you mentioned, you know, she goes back to art when she gets, you know, married in this, you know, very loving, democratic feeling.
Because she picks a good husband.
Right.
She picks a winner.
She finds joy and equality and love. And her mother is such a strong woman in her choosing of her relationships as well. I just think that this offers also a broader portrait of what women's lives have been and could be.
Fully agree. And I think specifically zooming in on Injia Flatun, I think Ursula, you mentioned, I think to the English speaking world, in the art history, in the space, a lot of people know her for that period in prison and her famous paintings from then. But I think there was only limited secondary secondary articles about the rest of her life. And I think what this book does is that it enables access for you know, the English-speaking world and art historians to the rest of her life. And actually, I think in 2022, I was meeting with Ustaz Sultan in the UAE, and he introduced me to Gabriella Nugent, who was an art historian at the time. And he mentioned to her that I was working on the translation of this book, and she was very excited because she was very interested in delving deep into Injia Flatun's relationship with Mexican muralists like David Alfaro Siqueiros. And actually, that turned into an essay that ended up in the book. So I think what this does specifically in terms of Injia Flatun's life is that it opens access to the other equally rich parts of her life other than her time in prison to the English-speaking world, whether in art history or beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still thinking about the word audacity, which one of you just said. And I think that's one of the things that's very characterizes her life for me. I mean, because not only did she hold these beliefs, she like really staked her life on them. Like she really took risks, right? She really paid prices for them. She was very serious. She was serious in her convictions, serious in her work, in her art. So I think there's a sort of audacity and determination that are both on a personal level really fascinating about her. And then, yes, that there's much more to her story than just the sort of basic outline that one might be familiar with.
Yeah. And just to touch briefly one more time on kind of her intersections with global movements. As Ahmed mentioned, she met David Alfaro Siqueiros in Cairo right before the Suez Crisis. Angela Davis also visited Egypt And she was involved in lots of international meetings with very prominent socialists and and international activists throughout her life. So she's just been involved in so many things that I think the book has so many rich touch points for future research. And I really hope that we see kind of an explosion of new directions for the exploration of collaboration between artists and social movements around the world as a result of this publication.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to do another reading to end this episode. That's something that is going to speak to about both her art and her political commitments. Marsha, I'll let you introduce it. Before I do that, because we will end with this reading, I want to thank you guys so much for this conversation, which we have been looking forward to for a long time, and for this beautiful book that you guys helped make happen.
Thank you, Marsha and Ursula. This is such a great opportunity, and we really are big fans of your podcast, and thank you for bringing this type of work to the forefront.
Our pleasure.
Absolutely. So in this section where she's in prison, which I think, speaks to some of the things that are more commonly known about her and some of her very iconic work, she's talking about how she both got the right to paint in prison and how that came about and how she got her paintings out. So it starts, around the same time, my sister Buli was bustling around for her husband Ismail and me. She would go from one place to another until she was able to get an official permit for me to paint. She would supply me with the necessary tools, and then the painting would have to go through the Secret Service, followed by the prison service before she was able to receive them. Buli was truly amazing. Gaining permission to paint in prison was largely thanks to her. After a while, I discovered that 11 of my paintings had been confiscated. I nearly went crazy and decided to start smuggling the paintings. I faced two problems. Firstly, where would I work and paint? I was painting in a cramped ward where I had 20 fellow prisoners. The painting would be knocked over every 5 minutes. After a while, I was able to win some privileges from Abbas Qutb, the general district manager, who was a smart man with a strong personality. He would take some paintings to display at his home in return for some privileges, like leaving the ward door open and avoiding being overly stringent. He would let me in the yard after the outdoor break time to paint. He was an art lover who took advantage of my imprisonment. After some time, I was in dire need of these privileges to be able to move my paintbrush. This Abbas Qutb is in possession of a large collection of my paintings. The second problem. How were the paintings going to be smuggled? I would wait for a painting to dry and then pass it to one of the prison guards, who would wrap it around her body under her clothes. I worried that this process of smuggling would be exposed. It would have resulted in a total ban on my painting, a privilege that I'd miraculously gained. We had a specific guard who we called the high-speed train, who handed the paintings over to my sister for money. Some doctors also helped me with the smuggling because they were not searched. However, what worried me most was the artistic value of my paintings. My fellow prisoners didn't have enough aesthetic and artistic experience and would declare all my paintings to be good and successful. So I asked my sister through our secret letter exchanges to show my works to artists and experts. She reassured me that she showed some of the paintings to the artists Tahia Halim, Angelo de Rever, and others who were very pleased by and complimentary of the paintings. I wanted to draw the prison, but the prison warden warned me against it. One day, a high-ranking officer whose name I cannot remember came to visit the prison for an inspection. He requested to meet me and asked about what I painted and whether or not I drew the prison. I responded, "The head of the women's prison forbade me from drawing the prison." The officer then told the warden, "You have Injia Flatoon. This is a chance of a lifetime. Let her paint anything with complete freedom. This is an order." From that day onward, I set out without restraint or hesitation and took note of what I wanted to paint inside the prison. One of the most important people I captured in the prison was Inshira. She'd been sentenced to death, but the execution was delayed by a year until her baby was weaned. Of course, those sentenced to death wore red and were kept in a cell with a special watch to prevent them from committing suicide. Throughout the entire period awaiting for Inshira's execution, I empathized with the huge tragedy of her story. she'd killed and robbed under the pressure of harsh circumstances and extreme misery. When I asked to draw her, the prison warden, Hassan Qirdi, told me that it was depressing. I did paint her and her son, and it was one of the paintings confiscated by the Secret Service. On the other hand, the three paintings that I managed to slip from the confiscation were The Queue, The Dining Room, and The Sails of Dawn. One day, the situation changed. The new head of the prison informed me of a new order to prohibit painting for security reasons. I almost went crazy and decided to stop using the official route and instead smuggle all that I painted. My imprisonment began to gain significance as it started to seem like a period when I practiced my painting. I would often ask my fellow prisoners to leave me alone as I had no time and would impatiently set out to paint. After a while, I felt a disinterest in painting the prison and the prisoners and developed an attitude of disgust toward the prison. I started to paint the nature outside from behind the bars. There were gardens, trees, and flowers. I took a deep interest in capturing a tree that was close to the prison's barbed wire fence. I would paint it in every season, which taught me the precision required when focusing on a single object. You see, if I weren't in prison, I wouldn't have painted only one tree, as there are plenty to choose from. My fellow prisoners nicknamed it Inji's Tree.
Subscribe to Bulak wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books and Instagram at Bulak.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulak is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOUT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit ArabLit.org, where you can also subscribe to the ArabLit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulak or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulak@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.